Okay, as will probably be the case many times, I go back over what is on the exam that we're doing, because I'm used to having taught, I think I told you this before, and you'll hear this too many times, but I'm used to teaching just the part one. I haven't done the part two for many years, and so I got into the habit of knowing what was on the part one exams when I got to something in the notes, and I would, even if it's not written down, I'd remember to stress it. And so to make sure that I'm not skipping things, I'm going back and checking the exams and finding things, and I'm still forgetting to add things in the commentary. So what I wanted to add was about Jane Addams with the Hull House in 1886. That was on the sheet prior to this. The reason I went off into the Star Trek reference, which it never probably didn't make any sense, is because she received, and I don't know, I may have said this, but I didn't go into detail like I should have. She received a Nobel Peace Prize in 1931, the first American woman to do so. And while it was for anti-war activism, which I'll talk about in a minute, it's also kind of like a lifetime achievement award for her work at the Hull House, which she wrote about in a book called 20 Years at Hull House, I forgot to mention that, and published in 1906, I believe, or 1909, rather. The 20 Years at Hull House was probably one of the best accounts at describing all the problems that not just immigrants, but lower-income urban working lot plight was involving. So a lot of the progressive reform measures, is this too bassy, or is this, okay. Okay. A lot of the progressive reform measures that occurred between 1900 and 1916 were based upon muckraking literature, books that expose corruption and problems, and her work, 20 Years at Hull House, went a long way towards social legislation. Things like making buildings safer for fire, against fires, and making sure that building standards met certain electrical codes, etc. These were all things that she, when she described the sufferings that the people she dealt with went through in her book, that became kind of like the leading piece of literature for that. And I haven't read all of it, but parts I've read always kind of tug at your heart, and one I read about was how many mothers had to spend a full day at work while nobody watched their children, and hopefully they could come to the Hull House or go from school to some kind of a daycare operation. And one of the reasons she set up the house early on was the story that this mother told about working all day and finding out that her unattended child had fallen off of a like 8-story building and died and laid there unattended until she got home and searched for the child and found it. And these are some of the things that that make the Hull House so valuable, as well as the book that she wrote, such a piece of resource for reform legislation. Now back to the Peace Prize. Again, it's not just because of her social work. Peace Prize was also because she was an anti-war activist in the 1920s and the 1930s. And to put this into perspective of the Star Trek thing, which obviously Star Trek's not going to be on the test, but the reason I brought that up, well, it should be, but it won't be. Well, the reason I brought it up is because if you're familiar with the attitude about World War I and World War II, what was the feeling? Well, let's kind of just, we're going to do all this anyway together, but how did World War I end? Hi, welcome. Well, we won, I know. But in addition to that, I mean, like, what treaty concluded it? The Versailles Treaty. And the Versailles Treaty was remembered, well, before we get into that, and again, I'm stealing all from my future lecture, but what proposal did Woodrow Wilson put forth as what he thought would be a just and lasting peace for the end of the war? Anybody remember? 14 points. You've heard of the 14 points, maybe? It was Wilson's proposal for what would be a way that the war could end in such a just manner is that future wars would never have to happen again. Among the 14 points were the League of Nations, a forerunner of the United Nations. This Wilson did not get all 14, he probably got at best probably 5 or 6 of the 14 points enacted. And the League of Nations part, which did get accepted, we never joined. And the League of Nations didn't have the power in the 20s and 30s to stop the new aggression of Japan, Italy, and Germany. So when the war ended in 1919, of course people were proud and excited about having defeated Germany and brought peace to the world, and the democracies defeated the non-democracies. But by the 30s, when the Depression hit hard, and here was Hitler and Stalin and Mussolini and the Japanese fascists all threatening nearby democracies, and we seemed to have no desire, no feeling to be a part of this, that isolationism in the 30s brought a cynicism that made people feel that World War I was a mistake. It didn't bring it wasn't a war to end all wars. It didn't make the world safe for democracy. So we shouldn't have ever fought the war. And how did we get into the war? Well, the belief was we got dragged into the war by what were called merchants of death, munitions makers and bankers who pushed the war effort in order to sell their products or make loans off of the Allies. So in the late 20s and early 30s, there was a hardened isolationist attitude, let's not get tricked by going back into wars that deal with Europe or Asia. That we have two oceans to protect us, we never needed to be in World War I, let's stay out of World War II. So that fits the time period when she was an anti-war activist. If she received the Nobel Peace Prize in 1931, that's right in the middle of that period where Americans were very guarded against activist foreign policy, and people like her would be looked up to with great admiration. Plus, also kind of interesting is in 1931 was the first time that any of these future Axis, the real Axis, not Axis of Evil stuff now, but I mean the real Axis power, the first time that they actually invaded anybody was Japan, invading China and Manchuria in 1931. So the awarding of the Nobel Prize to Jane Addams in 31 was a way of the Nobel Committee trying to suggest that we don't need to be stampeding into another war, and people like Jane Addams who advocate pacifism and advocate staying out of the war should be looked up to with this award. So that's why I parallel it to the Star Trek thing, because in the same way that little fictional story had it set up to where she had delayed entry into World War II and the Nazis won and then the world turned out wrong. And that's kind of the understanding of the whole story of 20th century anyway, is that we waited too long anyway to get into the war, and probably wouldn't have gotten into the war had it not been for Pearl Harbor. So that World War I, World War II contrast becomes the basis for the rest of the whole 20th century look at the Cold War, the War on Terror. Everybody is drawing somewhere by saying, shouldn't have gotten in like World War I, should have gotten in sooner like World War II, and everybody judges foreign policy based on the first half. So that's why that I thought Jane Addams has some real relevance to all of the rest of the 20th century. But now we're back on the politics sheet. Yes?
What was the name of the book?
20 Years at Hull House. And I thought sure that I had found a paperback copy of what was called Another 20 Years at Hull House many, many years ago. And I went looking on throughout the internet for it, and it doesn't exist. It must have been a dream or something. But if you see Another 20 Years at Hull House, let me know and confirm that that's not just my strange memory. Can you hear this? Is this okay? Is it working? I'm sure it's not as clear as usual, but it seems to be working. In. Okay, so we made it to number 8 on the next sheet. Is that correct? And we're some of the things that we covered last time, not to repeat them all, but just to try to make sure we're up to speed on things, is that voter turnout was quite high in the I'll be back. As I say at the high school, talk among yourselves. And they do. They know how to do it. Okay, I'm back. Okay. As I said before, voter turnout was quite high in the Gilded Age period, not because candidates or issues were that exciting, but because of the loyalties to ethnicity, religion, or which side of the Civil War you identified with, North and South. Democrats did have different issues than Republicans, but it's real common for people to common today for people to say you can't tell Democrats and Republicans apart. But it's even more true in the end of the 19th century. There were some distinctions, but they're minute in comparison to party politics across the planet. Most political parties across the planet are very ideologically based. So if you've got a liberal party or a conservative party, or a Christian Democrat Party, or a Socialist Party, they're telling the truth. That's what they believe, and most of the people believe that. Whether they come from the northern or southern portion of their country, they're going to be ideologically disposed. In the United States, we don't have many multiple parties that ever get anywhere, so there's never coalition building going on in the legislatures. Thus, the two parties which really dominate, Democrat and Republicans, or whichever two have been, be it Whig and Democrat, have rarely been hardcore ideological. They're often much more varied according to geography and issues. So that's why if it seems like in any time period you study or even currently that the two parties seem to not have a lot of distinctive difference between them, that's the nature of American politics. Yet despite those similarities, Democrats in 4 and 5 did differ in this respect. As I said before, Democrats were for smaller federal government, more emphasis upon state authority. That phrase says states' rights. I hate the phrase states' rights. I want to go off into a rant right now about the phrase states' rights. For most liberals like myself, states' rights means southern segregationist racism. That's just code word for it. It doesn't have to mean that, but that's what we think. It's like literacy tests, it's always going to be racist kind of thing. But there's also a political mistake. States don't have rights. People have rights. Governments exist to preserve those rights. If governments have powers, not rights, they only have those powers because people grant them. So that's why I've always thought it should be states' powers. But the phrase states' rights has always really been a double meaning. Not only does it mean the powers of states, it means protection against federal tyranny, against federal intervention. So Democrats stood for that. Democrats wanted to see state government be strong and free from federal interference, and they would use the phrase states' rights. If possible, no government whatsoever was preferred, and that's the meaning of laissez-faire. And therefore, Democrats from their inception in 1828 up until 1928, or maybe 1932, believed that you protect the common worker, the common man, the immigrant voter, etc., by keeping government off people's backs. The less government, the better. The more people can choose for themselves on a level playing field, the more fair it is. Because most of the time in history, big government assisted the wealthy and the powerful. So that's why Democrats were laissez-faire. Republicans did favor the use of government, and the larger the better, the more federal, more states, the better. And some of that is because they were favoring the wealthy, but also because Republicans, and I kind of want to come back and stress this, is Republicans wanted to abolish slavery. Republicans took the lead on using government to stop things like what Jane Addams was fighting about, social ills and reforms. So they were for big government in all directions to help all communities. The giving away of land for free to Westerners, some of the poorest people, that was a Republican program which Democrats would not have favored. On the tariff issue, and now we're kind of moving from 4 and 5 down to repeating 7. On the tariff issue, Republicans were for a high tariff, Democrats were for a low tariff. High tariffs obviously work to protect business interests, but also it could be argued it helped consumers. But the fact that a tariff is a federal law makes it an activism that Republicans are more comfortable with than Democrats. They were for higher tariffs.
What did they protect?
They protect home business first and foremost. But you wouldn't make that argument. A Republican would not say it's important that Bill Gates be protected. It's important, you know, that Ted Turner be protected. They wouldn't say that. They would say we need to keep this money within the borders, so that all the American economy grows and invests rather than seeing money bleed out to the outside. That would be their argument. And it's an accurate one, too. And Republicans tended to be on the social issues, more in favor of protecting white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, nativist, I don't mean Native American Indian type, but nativist Americans over immigrants. And some of that was cultural in terms of guarded and fearful that the immigrants would not be able to embrace proper American traditions and values. More on the issues that either they agreed on or divided over, the civil service reform, that was the idea of whether you had to take a test in order to hold a federal job. Actually, both parties were in favor of civil service reform, Democrats more so than Republicans, because Democrats were the ones that never were in office, so they could complain all the corruption is coming from the Republican Party. And Republicans would have to be in favor of it in order to be in keeping with using government to be activist and helpful. And the reason I'm going back over these is as we go through the elections and the candidates and the policies, it will help you understand why one party or one issue is where they are. I was trying to be nice to Republicans. He looked unhappy. I'm doing the best to try and make a fair comment there. Abolished slavery, gave land away to farmers. Try my best. Anyway. Monetary standards, went over that before. To repeat that again, this meant whether or not gold alone would be used as currency, or whether gold and silver as a bimetallic currency would take place. And maybe it's important to go back and stress this at this point. From the start of the nation to 1914, I believe. I'm going to make a lie here. The federal government issued no paper money. Now that's false. because they did during the Civil War for a few years issue what are called greenbacks. But other than the few greenbacks in the Civil War period, no paper money was issued by the federal government. It was only gold and silver coinage. Now, there was paper currency in use, but it was banknotes. After the Federal Reserve System was created, that's when Federal Reserve paper notes are printed. But they're still, up until 1970, considered redeemable in similar value of gold and or silver, depending on what was the legal tender at the time. We'll talk more about these issues, but the main thing that differentiated people on this is if you print or coin both gold and silver, there's going to be more money in circulation. And that's going to inflate the economy. If you cut back to only gold, each piece of currency is going to be more valuable, but it's also going to cause, in the way of some people looking at, an inability for an economy to grow. So those who have the wealth are sitting on it, the bankers in essence. So gold and or silver would be an issue. And this, on this issue, both Democrats and Republicans, and I have a test question that asks this, both Democrats and Republicans had what were called gold bugs and or silverites, people who favored only gold or favored both gold and silver. And that will become the major issue of the 1896 presidential election. We'll get to that later. Silver or gold coinage. Get this hands on, see what I'm saying.
They were favored by both parties.
Both parties had those people who favored silver and gold being coined, or only gold being coined. And those who are in favor of gold only were called gold bugs, and those who wanted to see the bimetallic standard were called silverites. It'll make more sense later when we get down into the elections. And then the GAR, the Grand Army of the Republic, this was the Union Civil War Veterans Organization that sought and received higher and higher pension payments for family members as the years went on. Obviously, if it's only going to benefit Northern veterans, it's something Democrats don't want to be on board for because that's going to upset the Southern wing of their party. Republicans, on the other hand, have no Southern wing of the party, so they're just pleased as they can be to reward those who won, wave the bloody shirt and reward those who won the war. So that's how GAR pensions would go. So that's those are the parties, those are the issues. That's politics in a generic nutshell from 1 through 7. Now let's get into these elections that have come. Building up for the 1880 election. And, of course, you remember who won the 76th presidential election? Hayes. And he won it after a very disputed electoral count because he promised to do what? Yes, remove the Southern troops, ending Reconstruction period. So now we're moving into the 1880 election. First, we're going to look at the Republicans, who dominate presidential elections. They win almost every election from 1860 to 1932. I think there's two exceptions. The rest are Republican victories. Within the Republican Party, and this is so common. We've watched this recently in the Republican Party, and we saw it for a zillion years in the Democratic Party, is once a party gets in power, they may have worked in unity to get there, but then they factionalize and fight and stab each other in the back once they've become spoiled with power. Such happened to the Republicans by the 1880s. There were two wings in the party, one called stalwarts, as you see in number 8, and the other called half-breeds, which I don't see anywhere. Number 9, here it is in number 9, okay. Oh, it's up there, there it is, okay. Stalwarts and half-breeds. The stalwart wing of the party was led by Roscoe Conkling, and leader of the so-called half-breeds was James G. Blaine from Maine, as it would rhyme. I don't remember where Conkling was from. I think it was from New York, but I'm not sure. Originally, the two different factions, or the reason these factions came to be, was differences over Reconstruction policy. Reconstruction being from 1865 to 1877. If you favored a harsh, punitive policy over the South, make them stay out of the Union for a long time, keep the white leaders of the Confederacy disenfranchised for as long as possible. If you were for very, very harsh treatment of the defeated South, that's what originally was the meaning of being a stalwart, staying strong, stalwart on punishing the South. If, on the other hand, you were one who wanted to lax up soon, restore the vote, let the states be readmitted, don't be very harsh about mistreatment of African Americans in the South, you were derisively nicknamed a half-breed in the party. Well, by 1877, obviously, these two titles mean nothing because there's no more policy to be harsh or weak on. But by that point in time, what we have seen is these two wings of the party become factions that fight within the party for authority. And the new issue that replaces the difference is not Reconstruction, but patronage of the spoils system. I think I defined that before. Patronage is the giving away of jobs as favors for helping you get elected. And the nickname of it is the spoils system. It goes back to Andrew Jackson's days. Got its name when someone asked, why are you appointing all these people who can't even read and write to the federal government? The response was, to the victor goes the spoils. We won. That's it. Jobs for people who helped turn out the vote. The stalwarts favored more and more patronage or exercising the spoils system. They thought it was democratic. It was service for service. Common people vote, they ought to be rewarded for it. You turn out more votes, you ought to get more reward. The half-breeds, on the other hand, argued that if the Republican Party was supposed to be the party of reform, anti-slavery, clean government, honest government, it was embarrassing for them to be engaged in so much of just jobbery going on, as they would call it, just giving away jobs to people who couldn't even handle it out of a favor for probably stuffed ballot boxes anyway. So that's why Blaine and the half-breeds argued that we need to portray ourselves as the clean, honest party. The Democrats started this stuff. We know they're corrupt. Let's not let our own party take on that image. Well, in the 1880 election, Conkling wanted to have Ulysses S. Grant to run again. Grant had run and won in 1868 and 1872. And we didn't cover this, but if you look at the Grant years, they're filled with some pretty embarrassing scandals that occurred. They get their mystic start right around 1872, just before re-election, which I've always thought was very mystic in comparison to a century later, when Watergate takes place in the summer of 72, right before the re-election. And in both cases, knowledge of scandals surface after the re-election has occurred. Grant left office in 1877, it was pretty much with a lot of embarrassment and shame that he had been such a weak administrator and allowed so much corruption to occur. And the odd part about the election was that when Hayes ran and Tilden ran, both of them, Hayes the Republican and Tilden the Democrat, they both ran on clean, honest government. Let's guarantee the voters that both our parties will not be as mired in the spoils as was the Grant administration. And then oddly enough, the way Hayes wins the election is through the favor of pulling the troops out. And he was the more honest candidate, and yet he got labeled with that, his fraudulency. And I often thought this, you know, he got labeled from the get-go that this was a presidency that was achieved through dishonest means or through, you know, less than democratic means, and it doomed him for re-election. He was never even considered for candidacy. None of that seemed to haunt Bush. Why not after 2000? Your answer might be because he won it fair and square, but any other explanation? Pardon? A lot of people like me like to claim September 11th, that 9/11 did it, wiped everybody's memory of the dishonest election. That's just not fair, because I can remember all the way through spring and summer, people were already starting to like him. They were liking his policies, so... there was never that image hanging over. I mean, Democrats wanted there to be that image, but it just wasn't in the public eye. If you look at the polls, people were up 60-70% favoring this guy before 9/11. But history can go any way you want, so if you want to write at 9/11, I wouldn't mind, but it wouldn't be accurate, but I'd like to spread it that way. Well, anyway, back to the spoils here. What Conkling wanted was a third term for Grant. Conkling's thinking on this was, back when Grant was president, corruption and spoils flowed like wine. We had a great time. Let's run Grant for president again. And so the movement was to try to get him as his candidate, which was not going to go anywhere because some people already knew that he was dying of throat cancer. In fact, in his final years, he was quite impoverished. And it was Mark Twain who wrote his autobiography for him that helped pay for the doctor bills at the end of his life. So Grant wouldn't have been a serious candidate. But that's what the stalwarts were wishing for. Half-breeds, on the other hand, were in number nine here. Half-breeds wanted to see their own leader, James G. Blaine, be candidate so they could restore honesty to the party. Well, they compromised. And instead of seeking either Grant or Blaine, they went with James A. Garfield, who was a kind of lukewarm half-breed, and his running mate, Garfield is from Ohio, his running mate Chester Allen Arthur from New York, who was the second in command under Conkling of the stalwarts. So the compromise is a mediocre half-breed for the top of the ticket, and the second most powerful stalwart, Arthur, running with him. That was their plan. Yes. James A. Garfield is the top of the ticket. He's the presidential candidate from Ohio. Well, he's Republicans. See, the stalwarts wanted Grant, the half-breeds wanted Blaine, but eventually they compromised as a party solidly behind Garfield and Arthur. Not real solidly, but they compromised. They were running for, yes. They were the presidential and vice presidential Republican candidates. And they're going to win, too. Democrats that year, tired of having the bloody shirt waved at them continuously, decide, let's run a Civil War Union general. If you run a general, surely like a Swift Boat leader or something, you can't. Can't have anything go wrong there, can you? Somebody who's actually a veteran, I think. So, and in addition to that, they chose one who was named for a famous general. Winfield Scott Hancock, their candidate, was named for Winfield Scott. And Winfield Scott was one of the biggies. I mean, he had fought in the War of 1812. He was the victorious general of the Mexican War in 1848. At the start of the Civil War, he was placed in command of Union troops. He couldn't walk, but he was in command until after Bull Run. So the name Winfield Scott carries with it lots of patriotic, loyal Union imagery to it. And to nominate someone who was young enough to be named for him and be a general in the Civil War, how can you lose? Well, they still lost. They waved the bloody shirt and people still associated him with rebellion. And so Garfield and Arthur won in the 1881 election. And we went through this earlier. Do you remember we said that there are 2 years where there's been three presidents in 1 year? This is one of them. Hayes finishes in his lame duck period. Garfield gets elected and takes office, but before the year is over, he is shot and killed in 1881 at the Union train station in item 11. So what this sheet is somewhat misleading. It should have said, 11 should have said, Garfield and Arthur win, comma, then Garfield killed by Gateau. If that clarifies number 11 any. Charles Gateau was a French immigrant, insane person who was seeking a federal job and believed that if he killed Garfield, stalwart Arthur would be so appreciative of getting to become president that he would reward him with a job. He didn't. He just had him arrested and later executed. But it kind of brought attention to the point where are we so deeply involved in the spoil system that we kill people to get jobs? Is that where we're at? That's kind of what the image went with that. And so, to many of his stalwart friends, Chester Allen Arthur surprised the nation by signing into law the Pendleton Act of 1883, number 12. The Pendleton Act created the first civil service examination, civil service reform. So this is the first step towards getting a handle on this spoil system. And I guess the irony here is that here the people who wanted the spoil system the most, the stalwarts, their second in command is the one who signed it into law. Conkling was not impressed at all, and a lot of the stalwarts were angry. And in fact, there was a story about where they went to the White House and complained, trying to talk to their old buddy and say, you know, what's with you, Chester? Why did you do this? And he goes, I'm no longer President Chester, I'm President Arthur. So he was distancing himself from the faction. He wanted to have a legacy of not being involved in this spoil system. However, on other issues, he remained pretty consistent to Republican values, such as seeking GAR pension increases and seeking higher tariffs, although it will not come during his year. In 1884, Arthur is not renominated, many because of this mad at him for the Pendleton Act, but also because Arthur would not have sought the office. He was dying of throat cancer, or mouth cancer, jaw cancer at the time. So it'll be an open field for new candidates in 1884 in item 13. Again, the issues of corruption in government loom. So both parties want to put forward honest, clean government candidates. The Republicans this time get united behind the half-breed leader, James G. Blaine, who Democrats would later call the James G. Blaine, the Continental Liar from Maine. But the hopes were that Blaine would be able to promote the honest image of the party. Cleveland was chosen by Democrats for the same reason. He'd been a governor of New York, started out as a Buffalo sheriff of Buffalo, New York, and had made his name fighting against corruption, had been involved in helping to bring down Tammany Hall, especially Boss Tweed, who we talked about. So both candidates come into the election with the idea of if you vote for Blaine or vote for Cleveland, because they'll keep the government honest and clean up the corruption. No, Blaine's a Republican, half-breed leader of the Republican Party, and Cleveland's a Democrat. All I've really said about Democrats was that Winfield Scott Hancock was the candidate in 80 and he lost, and now I've said that Cleveland is the candidate in 84, and all the other talk was about Republicans. Well, problems arise quickly with Blaine, and that is rumors start to abound that for being supposedly the clean, honest government candidate, he's actually involved in some graft and corruption. And to make this make sense, let's jump to 15 for a second, then I'll come back to 14. There was the accusations that Blaine had drawn lots of money off of the Credit Mobilier scandal in the 1870s. No proof to it, just accusations. And some of that was because a few years earlier in 1869, Blaine had been accused of misallocating money and pocketing it in what were called the Mulligan paper case. Rumors abounded that he had, as I said, overappropriated and embezzled money from the government in 1869. But it was a rumor that went away until he became candidate in 84. In 1884, private diaries surfaced in which they said the same thing the Mulligan papers had talked about in the past were back being circulated, and the railroad that we're talking about was from Little Rock to Fort Smith, Arkansas. In fact, let me put a preface to this election. This 1884 election is going to involve corruption in Arkansas, the fathering of illegitimate children, the accusations of widespread sleeping around, draft dodging. Now, this may all sound like 1990s, Whitewater, etc., but no, it's 1884. So the Mulligan papers insinuated or accused Blaine of having skimmed money off of the railroad deal that connected Little Rock to Fort Smith. Accused back in 69 and now in 1884, supposedly new evidence has surfaced to accuse him of this. Not hard enough evidence to prove it. It's kind of like CBS notes about did somebody serve their time in Alabama or something like that. But just enough to cast aspersions on Blaine. So members of the Republican Party, angry at their own candidate, angry at Blaine for maybe being involved in corruption, decide they're going to teach their party a lesson that year by voting for the other side. So a faction of Republicans leave the Republican Party and vote for Grover Cleveland, as we see in item 14. And they are going to be derisively called mugwumps. These are Republicans who bolt the party and vote Democrat in that election. So Republicans mad at James G. Blaine for possibly being involved in corruption after claiming to be the clean government candidate punish their own party by voting for Cleveland. The term mugwump There's no real clear origin to the word. Some believed it was a Native American word that meant big chiefs. Therefore, these people were going to be holier than thou and punish the party the hard way by voting for the other side. Others say that it just meant they were people who couldn't make up their mind. They were sitting on a fence with their mug on one side and their wump on another. 19th century political humor. Well, the story thickens. When the Republicans decide, we know how to go after this, let's wave the bloody shirt. Doing some investigating, they discovered that Grover Cleveland never served in the Civil War. Instead, he hired a draft substitute. You could pay $300 to get somebody to take your place. So here's a cowardly Democrat who would not serve in the war by hiring someone else to do his responsibility. We'll use that against him. Someone in the campaign, however, was smart enough to say, wait a minute, we better check our own candidate to make sure he's not got trouble. And they checked on Blaine, and he had done the same thing. So since they both hired draft substitutes, they dropped that strategy. Well, then the Republicans found another piece of news that could be useful. It was rumored that Cleveland had fathered an illegitimate child with a lady of the evening while still being married. And when it was released to the news, and when the news people approached Cleveland about this, did you father an illegitimate child? His response was, yeah, I did. Maybe. I said, what do you mean, maybe? And to make the story worse, he said, well, there were about five of us who all used the lady's services, and none of us really knew who was the father, so we all took responsibility and chipped in. So that was Cleveland's response. So Republicans then came up with a slogan that they thought would help them out by emphasizing who belongs where by saying, Ma, Ma, where's my pa? Gone to the White House, ha, ha, ha. That was the Republican slogan, making fun of Cleveland. Democrats tried to respond. They didn't have anything near as rhythmical or catchy by saying, if Blaine is so good at home and so corrupt in government, and Cleveland is the reverse, send each man where they belong. Blaine back home and Cleveland to Washington. Not catchy, but address the issue. Still, these things did not turn the 1884 election. I mean, they made it exciting. But the major feature, welcome, major feature of the 1884 election takes place in number 18 and 19. In New York, a fundraising dinner occurred that Blaine attended, Republican fundraising dinner, and a Protestant minister was the speaker before Blaine at this activity, and the minister rose and spoke derisively about Democrats, claiming the Democratic Party is nothing but a party of rum, Romanism, and rebellion. And when Blaine followed him, he said nothing. He didn't agree, he didn't recant, he just acted like he didn't hear it. It might be similar to, well, this is a bad parallel, but back in 1984 when, who's head of the Nation of Islam? The guy that's head of the Nation of Islam. A Million Man March. Farrakhan, Louis Farrakhan, had made some extremely strong anti-Jewish remarks. And Jesse Jackson, who was seeking the presidential candidacy in 84, had his problems with those kind of remarks in the past and had tried to clean himself up, and he was trying to straddle the fence and be mainstream popular but also keep the Nation of Islam on his side. And so when Farrakhan made all these anti-Jewish remarks and Jackson said nothing about it, didn't distance himself or criticize Farrakhan, many said that hurt and destroyed Jackson's candidacy for being anything serious. So put that into parallel, if there is a parallel. When Blaine refused to repudiate the remarks made by this minister, it cost him the election. Well, what was so wrong with the remarks? Let's look at each aspect. What does the rum part mean? Okay, and if you go a little further and take the Romanism part, what's Romanism mean? So who are Roman Catholic drinkers? The Irish. So therefore the impression is these unloyal, dangerous, alcoholic, Catholic elements make up the Democratic Party. And then one more, the rebellion part implies Southern Democrats. It's bloody shirt activity. So nothing. So the Democratic Party, according to this minister, is nothing but a bunch of foreign drunken papist Southern slaveholding rebels, which was quite the insult to the Irish voters who lived up in northern states. And so that year, every single eligible Irish voter, and for that matter probably ineligible, that stuffed the ballot boxes, turned out with iron lungs in hand and whatever it took to get to the polls. They turned out record numbers and made sure that Cleveland won that election. So that's what turned the 1884 election. It wasn't illegitimacy, it wasn't draft dodging, it wasn't corruption in Arkansas. It was the classic issue that turned elections, which way in ethnicity and which way of Civil War heritage did people identify. So Cleveland became the first democratically elected president. I don't mean that in small d, I mean first Democrat party member to be elected president since 1856. He'll also be the only president that does what compared to all the other presidents? Anything unique about his way of serving? He did get married in the White House to someone like in her 20s, and he was in his 50s. So I think he either came to the office as a widower or she died in the early years. But that's kind of what happened to Woodrow Wilson, too, so that's not... Nothing to do with tariffs. Nothing to do with issues. He's the only president to serve two terms non-consecutively. Yeah, every other president that served two terms was reelected. So he's elected in 1884. He will lose the 88 reelection bid. We'll talk about that in a moment. But he'll run a third time and win in 92. So he serves from, if we go from the lame duck years, he serves from 1885 to 1889 and then again from 1893 to 1897. That's the unique thing about Cleveland. But he ran all three times. As a president, he exercised numerous vetoes, which tells us something that Republicans dominated both houses during his presidency, he's entering these vetoes. In fact, the only president who vetoed more than Cleveland in the 19th century was Andrew Jackson. And I think the next president to veto more than both of them would be FDR, and that's strange to think that somebody who has your party controlling Congress for 14 years, you can have more vetoes than any other president. But Cleveland exercised numerous vetoes and justified it on the grounds of negative activism. In other words, he's protecting the people from Republicans who want to do too much. They want to make too much law, make too much government. But some of what that was involved GAR pensions. He saw no need to see these pension increases go to grandchildren and grandnephews and that nature. People who had not served in the war didn't need these pensions. They could get a job. But that was fell right into the trap of the bloody shirt waving, because here he is not remembering the troops and supporting patriotism, and he's probably Romanism rebellion and all that. So that will be a factor why he loses re-election in 88. Cleveland also was a strong low tariff person, and that got business higher up. So both veterans of the war and business elements were upset at Cleveland for his policies, whether it was vetoing GAR pension increases or vetoing tariffs. So the 1888 election comes, and item 21. Cleveland runs for re-election against Benjamin Harrison. What political family does Harrison relate to? Yes. In fact, I think the way to say this would be John Scott Harrison, a senator, is the only man to have had a father be a president and a son to be a president. Because William Henry Harrison was the grandfather of Benjamin Harrison. So Harrison and Cleveland run. And as we said, the business elements and the veterans elements oppose Cleveland. Cleveland will win more popular votes than will Harrison. But Harrison will win more electoral votes and thus becomes president. Will that ever happen again? Yeah. in our lifetime, 2000, right? That'll be the first time. So maybe the way people think about this thing is 1888 to 2000, what's that? That's 112 years. If it takes another 112 years to happen again, we don't need to fix the system. That's pretty good odds. Even this election still turned, however, on ethnicity again, and here is why. During the election, a Republican campaigner from California pulled a trick on Cleveland, pulled a trick that hurt Cleveland. He wrote a letter to the ambassador from Britain in Washington, D.C., claiming to be Murchison. I don't remember his real name, but that was a fake phony name. And he said that this Republican campaigner who claimed to be Murchison, who wrote the letter to the British ambassador, said that he was a former British citizen, naturalized American. And while he's loyal to America, he still has feelings for good old England, and wanted to ask his ambassador a question in the letter. The question was, on the issue of tariffs, I'd like to know, tariffs, the way he put this, a tariff hurts English goods, so therefore we ought to be for low tariffs. But if we're for low tariffs, then I'm losing it. It was something about the issue of the way a tariff would go, what would help England in the vote? And the ambassador was foolish enough to answer the question and say, a low tariff would help British business. I'll have to go back and look this up. I didn't look it up before I got here. The outcome of the situation is it insults the Irish vote. I don't remember how and why, but when Murchison gets the response back from the British ambassador, he reveals this is what the British are really thinking, and therefore a vote for Cleveland helps the British. That's what it was. A vote for Cleveland helps the British because of low tariffs. So then the Irish get all mad because anything that helps the British pisses them off, and so therefore they all vote against Cleveland. Here they'd all voted for Cleveland in record numbers 4 years earlier because of the Romanism and Rebellion comment. Now, because the ambassador embraced low tariffs to help England and had suggested vote for Cleveland, they reverse. I'll check back about what were the details of the letter response. So that's the main reason that Cleveland lost the 80 re-election bid. During Harrison's administration, but the only real significant things that occur is the McKinley Tariff of 1890 in item 22. And not listed there, but will be listed later, is the Sherman Antitrust Act and Sherman Silver Purchase Act. We know about the Sherman Antitrust Act. We've talked about that in 1890. And then at the bottom of item 48, next page, is the Sherman Silver Purchase Act. So those are the three pieces of legislation that occurred during the Harrison administration. McKinley Tariff, Sherman Silver Purchase Act, and Sherman Antitrust Act. And the McKinley Tariff was an increase, as Republicans would normally embrace now that they control both White House and Congress. But Cleveland and Harrison run against each other again in 92, and the reverse takes place. Cleveland wins, Harrison loses. And there's two possible explanations for that outcome. There were no tricks with the Irish, and so the Irish stayed where they normally loyally go, and that's with the Democratic Party. The other possible explanation is the appearance of the populists. We talked a little bit about the populists and their attempts to manipulate Southern politics earlier. Well, most populists are really in the West, and they are traditionally going to be Republican voters. So populists took enough votes away from Republicans to give Democrats an advantage in 92. And so we're into in item 24, we're into a second Cleveland administration. Cleveland will seek, and he will get, a lowered tariff. He wins enough seats in Congress as well as re-election to push the tariff back down from where the McKinley tariff had placed it, in what would be called the Wilson-Gorman tariff. Critics in Congress argued that a reduction in tariff will mean a reduction in revenues necessary to run the government. We're building a navy. We have military bases in the West to cope with. And so Congress puts an earmark or an addenda or an item, as they're sometimes called, onto this tariff that says even though the tariff goes down, there will be a 2% income tax on incomes over, I think it was $3,000. It's the first, that's not true, it's the second income tax in the 19th century. There was one during the Civil War. Credit, pardon? 2% on incomes over 3,000, which was quite a bit in that period. It was challenged for its legality, went to the Supreme Court in 1895. This is the court that's becoming more and more concerned about protecting property rather than civil rights. And the court deems this income tax to be unconstitutional in the Pollock versus Farmers Loan and Trust case. Yes. The tariffs in 94 and the cases in 95. Both dates missing from the sheet, I'm sorry. Well, if the Supreme Court rules in 1895 that income tax is illegal, because the Constitution says taxes either must be based on a headcount population state by state or they must be trade regulations. So an income tax is neither one. How come we have it today? Because the socialists just took over and rammed it down our throats. That'd be a great answer, but it's not. I'd be for it, but no. How is the income tax legal? But why didn't the court just overturn it again if Congress came up and recreated it? To the court's benefit? Well, actually, most of the people that serve on the court are upper income people that'd be bitten by it. Except the first income taxes that occur in the 20th century are very steeped on high incomes. You don't start to see income tax on low incomes till about World War II. World War II is the reason they go up. I love this part. So FDR boosts them up. That's called soak the rich tax. If people don't want to pay those high income taxes, they hate America. They're pro-fascist. That was a good one. I like that one. But that still doesn't make it legal. If the court's pretty accurate. In 1895, the court looked at the Constitution and said, the only way Congress can levy federal taxes is trade regulation or by population count state by state. There we go. There's an amendment that gets passed. In 1913, the 16th Amendment declares income tax legal. It's 1913. Up in the Progressive Era, the 16th Amendment legalizes income tax. You may be surprised why it was first passed. I mean, I guess your thought would be so that you can raise money and redistribute it and spend it on socialist programs. They didn't figure that out until the 1930s. So there's another reason they do it. It's campaign finance reform. The argument is that super wealthy people who, after they've bought so many yachts and hamburger franchise, etc., by senators and by governors, and so therefore the way to keep politics honest is to put a lid on wealth. So that was the original purpose behind the income tax, was campaign finance. And then after they started raking in more and more money, they'd say, hey, we could use it for something else. So there's constantly things that come around on the internet arguing that income tax is illegal, even with the amendment that it's illegal. Because they argue, I think it was Minnesota and Wisconsin, no, Michigan and Minnesota, when they ratified the 16th Amendment, they did not ratify the same written amendment. It was worded differently in those two states. And taking those two states off, there isn't enough to have a 3/4 ratification vote. So since they didn't ratify it in the same written form, technically it's illegal. And they're probably right. But we like income tax, so don't say anything. Otherwise we couldn't have the socialist redistribution program. On property? Property tax exists at the state and or local level, but not the federal level. It's just income tax at the federal. But yes, if you're asking, do people get double taxed? Yes.
Do they have, like, with high incomes, I heard, well, I read it in social,
okay, I see what you're saying. That, like, for example, if you have a mortgage on a home, that you can get a deduction on your income tax. That still exists, but it's being phased out slowly, and almost all the other deductions are pretty well gone. But that one is one of the few left on there in order to encourage the housing market. It's a good deal. Yes. Yep, they clip us that way. Because we've got to pay teachers. And firemen. No, but that's it. We shouldn't have the grocery tax either. That's really unfair in terms of everybody's got to eat. But they're working on getting rid of it. That's right, yeah. But that's the main... It's not fair. It's not just what you've asked, but it's... She said, why are we, as well as paying sales tax... continually having to pay property tax on a vehicle.
For
Arkansas. It's true because we won't raise income taxes. We have to find other ways to raise money because people won't. And I heard Huckabee years ago say, why don't we raise the income tax? Because if we raise the income tax, businesses will all run to some other state. So in other words, to keep businesses here, we pay these kind of multiple other taxes individually. And state tax.
So, I don't understand why
they have a lot more people who... Yeah, that's true. We're one that has to balance budgets. But we just don't have, how can I say this? The business element has more control over the state legislature in this state than in many other states. One of the reasons for that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Favorable tax base. Here's the thing that I never understand. I visit my relatives in California, and I go to a place like, and I'll finish in a minute, but I visit, you know, some store like the grocery store, and the groceries cost the same or less than Arkansas.
Less,
usually. And it's not just groceries, it's a lot of things, automobiles and stereo equipment and everything. It's all the same price or cheaper, but people are getting almost twice as much in the way of pay and wages, and property costs for those businesses are so much exorbitantly higher than here. I guess what I'm thinking here is that either the business owners are making a whole lot less in California, or the ones here are just rolling in money. It's got to be the answer there. And you say, well, it's higher volume of sales. It's not higher volume of sales in little small backwoods cities of California where the situation is the same. But what I said was true well before the Walmart takeover. It was true back, you know, in the 80s and 70s.
And that's just true for the West because up north, you buy the same amount of groceries and it costs you four times more.
Okay. Yeah, I think it's just true for the West.
Just true for the West. My mother, when I was in Ohio, my mother bought groceries once and she was shocked at how much groceries cost in Ohio.
But
because they had sales tax.
Yeah, well, that's true. That's true. That's very true. Yeah. And California followed the same problem. At one time, you could get into most of the state universities without any tuition costs at all. And after that Reagan revolution, so to speak, where they cut back on all the property taxes, they've had to close so many schools and libraries and programs, et cetera. So that is the cost of that. But, well, we've got about 5 minutes left. Let's get back to the 1890s here. Item 25, Panic of 1893. I think we talked a bit about this already in terms of in the 19th century, there was a, I think I talked about this with you, there was an 1819 panic and an 1837, little one in 1857, one in 1873, and the one in 93 was the largest of the century, lasted the longest. It wasn't a surprise, though. It was one of those things that seemed to be right on target with the cycle of every 20 years or so. So it's hard to say whether or not this was just part of the business cycle finally taking its course, or whether people stampeding saying the sky is falling helped it happen in a hurry. But it is attributed to over-speculation on railroad stock, leading to bank failures and eventual unemployment. One of the things about this particular panic, which distinguished it from the earlier ones in the century, was it hit both rural and urban areas equally hard. The previous ones hit only urban areas. And one of the reactions, we'll talk about a number of them that occur. We've already talked some in the labor strikes. The 1894 Pullman strike is a response to the 93 panic. But one of these responses comes in the form of Coxey's Army in item 26. Jacob Coxey was a Civil War veteran who was also an avid populist. And we keep, you know, flirting with who these populists are, and we'll get to who they are in a little bit. But it should be obvious at this point that the populist represents the ordinary common working class people, at least they're trying to. And Coxey leads a group of unemployed Midwestern farmers from Ohio to Washington, D.C. in a protest rally, pretty large gathering too, a protest rally in D.C. in which they demand Congress print paper money in inflated amounts, and with the inflated paper money start creating public works projects. Needed or not, just create jobs. Create more highways, create courthouses for cities, create additional building spaces for colleges, etc. Not because the market demands it, but because there needs to be jobs made available for unemployed people. So their advocacy is to have paper money inflated and use that money to create makeshift jobs. And Cleveland refuses. Cleveland is a laissez-faire states' rights Democrat. He's opposed to it ethically. I mean, he wants to help people that are in trouble during the panic. But his argument is the classic argument. If we start printing paper money, we'll devaluate the money, and that'll ruin the future of the economy. And if we get into the habit of making jobs outside of the private market where there is no true market demand, we'll be forever stuck on dependent upon federal assistance rather than the market. And we may, in fact, stay in a depression. The 1893 panic may never resolve. You just have to tighten the belt and ride it out. And that's the approach Cleveland took, and it's also why he was so hated during the panic and not even considered for re-election in 96. The irony here is everything Cleveland refused to do is what FDR did do. FDR did devaluate the money. FDR did create the jobs. FDR did do what the critics say, and that is get us forever dependent upon federal programs and run off infinite deficits. And oddly enough, in the 1930s, things didn't get solved in a hurry. They went from 1929 all the way to 1939. And there were critics who said he shouldn't have done it like Cleveland didn't, because we would have been out of the Depression by the mid-30s. No, I don't believe that, but that's where the critics went. And so there's the difference in Democrats. Cleveland, the laissez-faire Democrat who refuses to give federal assistance, versus FDR in the 1930s. So instead of funding pork barrel projects, a term that means unnecessary wasteful spending, he had the protesters arrested for trespassing on the White House lawn. That was Cleveland's response. And as a result, public opinion moves very strongly in the direction of favoring the Republican Party, blaming Democrats, blaming Cleveland for the panic. So in the upcoming 1896 election, Republicans will have that advantage. That's a good pause point, and when we come back on 29, we'll talk about how farmers' economic problems figure into the creation of the Populist Party and influence the 96 presidential election.
People are going to do the same though.
Oh, that's like selling hoes and drugs and stuff.
It's like what?
Selling hoes and drugs. people ought to pay taxes because they're civic-minded, not because they can win something.
I believe in taxes. I believe in taxes.